Well, when we left Mary last week, she had just been visited by a stranger with some very interesting news. She was going to have a baby, though she was not yet married. And her kinswoman, we might say cousin, Elizabeth, who had waited and waited and waited to have a child, and only in her great old age is she going to have a child. But Mary got that message as well. In fact, Elizabeth was in her sixth month of pregnancy. And so the scene shifts in today's lesson, and Mary goes to visit Elizabeth. Now, all of that takes place in Luke in one sentence. But you have to understand, Mary lived up in Galilee, in Nazareth. She had to travel all the way down to the area around Jerusalem in the hill country of Judea in order to visit Elizabeth. So it did not take one sentence. It took several days. And she would not have gone unaccompanied. She would have had a male brother, a father, some male relative to accompany her on this trip, because women did not travel alone, and it was a dangerous road to travel. Now, she would have been traveling all that way to enter into the room with the woman who should be her mentor, whom she will honor. And instead, as soon as she enters the room, Elizabeth feels her baby kick and recognizes in that movement that she was in the presence of someone very, very special. And so she pays honor to Mary, this girl, this young, almost child, 12 or 13 probably. The last shall be first, and the first shall be last. The reversal is beginning. Now, we don't know for sure and aren't told by Luke what Mary was thinking all the way on that trip down from Galilee to Judea, but we have a pretty good idea. We think it has to do with a woman named Hannah. You see, in 1 Samuel, Hannah, like Elizabeth, was a woman who had wanted a child and wanted a child and wanted a child and waited and waited and waited, and no child had come. Every year she would go to the tent of meeting, and at the tent of meeting she would pray to have a child, and she would go back and no child. She would return the next year and pray to have a child, no child. Her husband, Elkanah, who could very well have divorced her for not having children, chose not to. In fact, when he gave his other wife, who could have many children, Peninnah, a portion of the food at the tent of meeting, he always brought Hannah a double portion because he felt compassion for her. One year she came and she was at the tent of meeting. She was rocking and praying and rocking and praying, and her lips were moving, but no sound was coming out. And when the old priest Eli saw this, he thought she was drunk. He came over and tried to get her out of the tent of meeting. He said, "Come back when you're sober. Get away from here." When she found her voice, she said, "You mistake me. I'm not drunk on wine. I'm drunk on grief. Because you see, God has not seen fit to give me a child." And the old priest realizes that he had made a mistake. And he offers her a blessing, which is a double-edged sword. He says, "May God grant you what you asked for." What he doesn't know, because though her lips were moving, no sound came out, is that she had promised God that if God would give her a child, she would give that child back to God's service. She would give the child up. Well, she returned. She and Elkanah returned. Pretty soon it was clear she was going to have a child. When the child was born, they named him Samuel. And of course, she had to carry through on her promise. She waited and waited and waited. Elkanah said, "When are you going to take him?" She said, "Let's wait till he's weaned." The oldest unweaned child in the village. It was embarrassing. But then one year she took him by the hand and she walked with him to the tent of meeting and she placed his hand into the hand of the old priest Eli. He was just a boy, knowing that she would see him only once a year after that. She had no idea what he would be facing. That he would face down the Hebrew people and say, "You want a king? You want to be like the nations? Let me tell you what a king will do for you. A king will take your sons and make soldiers out of them and send them to fight and die far away from you. A king will take your daughters and make slaves out of them." But when they insisted, God sent Samuel to find Saul and anointed Saul as king. And then when Saul didn't work out very well, God sent Samuel by night, surreptitiously, to a little town called Bethlehem. It means house of bread. To the house of a man named Jesse, to view his sons. And Samuel was there on a very dangerous mission. He was getting ready to anoint a king while there was another king already on the throne. He looked from son to son to son to son, and none of them were approved by God. Finally, thinking perhaps he had been mistaken, says, "Aren't there any others? Don't you have any other sons?" And almost as an afterthought, Jesse said, "Well, yeah, there's the youngest, you know, David, out keeping the sheep." And David, the boy, is brought in. And Samuel anoints him as king while Saul is still on the throne. A very dangerous political act in any age. What Mary didn't know, and what Elizabeth didn't know, is that Elizabeth's son John would face a very similar situation. He would recognize a king while there was a king already on the throne. Herod was king of the Jews, and yet John would proclaim this itinerant preacher, Jesus, as king. Once again, very dangerous. Now, how do we know, or why do we suspicion that that's what Mary was thinking of? Let me read something to you. In 1 Samuel, right at the very beginning, in chapter 2, let me encourage you to read all of 1 Samuel. It's wonderful, this story, all these stories. When Hannah has given birth, when she is ready to turn her child over to the hands of the priest Eli, she sings a song. I'm just going to read you a little portion of it. She says, "The Lord makes poor and rich. He brings low. He also exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap, to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world." Now, when Mary arrives to visit with Elizabeth, she sings a song as well. Listen to this. "He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich empty away. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promise he made to our ancestors, to Abraham and his descendants forever." That's why last week I called Mary a prophet. These are prophetic words. When Hannah speaks them, when Mary speaks them, it's a good thing the NSA wasn't listening in on this. She would be taken into custody, at least questioned. This is seditious talk. This is revolutionary talk. It's talk about turning the order as we have designed it upside down. That's what prophets do. Whether that prophet is Hannah, or whether that prophet is a girl barely into her teens named Mary, or whether that is her son Jesus, who lives his life preaching about a kingdom that turns everything we expect upside down, or whether it's Elizabeth's son John, who says, "If you have two coats, give one away. If you collect taxes, don't collect more than you're supposed to. If you're a soldier and you have power over the other people, don't use it to abuse them." Jesus staked out his own place in the line of the prophets, in the line of Isaiah and Jeremiah, Amos and Micah. Because you see, the understanding of the prophets is that the way things are, the way we have designed things, is not the way God wants them to be. And God enters into the world again and again, trying to help us turn them so they'll be aright. Because you see, in our understanding, the wealthy and the powerful, that's us. That's all of us in this world, okay? The wealthy and the powerful and the privileged serve ourselves. It's too easy for us to forget about the people who aren't wealthy and powerful and privileged, who are pushed to the margins. They become invisible to us. Did you hear what Mary said? God takes us down and lifts them up. That's scary stuff, isn't it? But that's how God helps to correct that balance or imbalance that we have created. Our witness as Christians is to live into that vision that Mary sang about, that Hannah sang about, that the prophets spoke about, that John prophesied about, and that Jesus lived out even to the point of being crucified, because he was indeed dangerous, seditious, a threat to those in power. We are called to take seriously the kingdom that he described, which is not of this world. It's not like any kingdom that you have ever experienced. It's not like any empire you've either read about or lived as part of. We know that what Mary is singing about is true. Empires come and go. There is no Roman Empire anymore. There is no Babylonian Empire anymore. Our empire will go one day. Those of us who are privileged and wealthy, one of the days, and we don't know when that will be, we will wind up in the grave, just like the poor. And we'll stand before the same judge. Our job is to help this kingdom come about. For those of us who are privileged, to care for those who don't share those privileges. For those of us who have lots, to share with those who have little or nothing. That's how we witness to the presence of God and the work of God in the world. That's what Jesus taught us to do. And when he says his kingdom is not of this world, it's not. It's not built around our designs about who's important and who's not, about who's powerful and who's not, about who's deserving and who's not. That doesn't impress God, not one bit. God is here to take the last and make them first, to take the first and make them last. I use the word them because it's a little too scary to say us. It's even scarier to say me, because it applies to me too. But you see, the good news is we have the vision of a kingdom that's different from that. And we have it from Hannah, and we have it from the prophets, and we have it from Mary, and we have it from John, and we have it from Jesus who lived it out. And we are invited to participate in that. We are invited to make our witness to a kingdom that is not of this world, that will not pass away, because it is built upon bringing those who are invisible to light. Bringing those who have been pushed far away close. Lifting up those who have been downtrodden, who've been stepped on. Helping those who feel helpless and hopeless. Making sure everyone has at least the basics of what they need: food and shelter and clothing and health care, clean water. And we're called to be part of that kingdom. We in this church do that. I mean, you read about some of the things that we do. We don't do it perfectly, but we aspire to that. And it's during this season that we hear these challenging words. Because that sweet little baby Jesus grew up, and he challenged the most powerful people in the world, And he paid the price for it. And God took the worst thing that the Roman Empire could design to do to a human being and turned it into something that gives new life, not just to Jesus, but to the rest of us. That's why he's called the Prince of Peace. He's not called the Prince of Judgment. He's not called the Prince of Prosperity. He's not called the Prince of Warfare. He's not called the Prince of Hatred. He's called the Prince of Peace. Because participating in this kingdom is the way to peace. He showed us that way. And so our question is, who are we going to follow? Which empire are we going to live in? Which kingdom do we inhabit? The kingdom of the world? It'll pass away. We'll pass away. Or the kingdom of our God and of his Christ. That's why we call him Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Because you see, of his kingdom, there will be no end. That's the kingdom I want to aspire to be a part of. How about you? I suspect it's the kingdom you would like to aspire to be a part of too.